Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up outside Ann Arbor and earned an advanced degree in appraisal studies from New York University. She's the founder of a firm that provides appraisal and auction services and has been a star appraiser on PBS's Antiques Roadshow since 1997. She's appraised billions of dollars worth of collectibles in this male-dominated profession. Her name, Caroline Ashley, and we're honored to have her as our guest. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with the star appraiser on PBS's Antiques Roadshow. For the last 14 years, Caroline Ashley. Caroline, welcome, an honor to have you.
It is definitely my honor to be here today. Thank you for inviting me, Jack.
You're welcome. Can we start by talking about your parents and your childhood?
My pleasure. I, as you mentioned, grew up outside of Ann Arbor, and I had a wonderful childhood in that I was surrounded by a lot of fabulous objects, art, antiques, and interestingly, this is not dissimilar to a lot of ways in which people in my profession came up. They were born into families who were really involved in antiquing. For instance, the Kino brothers, Leslie and Lee Kino, on the Antiques Roadshow, they, among many others, grew up this way. And so I think that we kind of learned our trade almost by osmosis, you know, being around these wonderful objects and really being influenced by them, you know, growing up at our parents' knees with all of these wonderful visual stimuli all around us. And I think it's in our blood, so to speak. So I had the advantage of growing up with parents that had a really good eye, and I think that put me in good stead for my future career.
Now, your parents bought an old church in New Hudson and named it Noah's Ark.
Yes, they did. And the fun part of that was that I got to go there in the summertime when I was a student. I would come home from college and work there in the family business, which they had in their retirement, chock full of all these amazing things they'd collected over the years. It was sort of like the old woman in the shoe. They had so many things they didn't know what to do. So they opened this great space called Noah's Ark Antiques, and I got to work there and hone my skills.
What's the biggest thing you learned from your mom, Caroline, and what's the biggest thing you learned from your dad?
Well, from my dad, I learned to dicker with the best of them. He really taught me, you know, how to drive home a deal. And he was a great businessman. He had a wonderful business mind. So I learned the financial side from him. But my mom, I learned the aesthetic side. You know, she was the one who really could identify these unusual things. And then my father taught me, you know, how to sell them in the best venue and to get the most money for them. So I really had the advantage of learning wonderful skill sets from each parent.
Growing up on the south side of Chicago, there were no antiques, but there was a lot of junk. Caroline, what's the difference between antiques and junk?
You know, that's in the eye of the beholder, right? You know, what one person's junk is another person's treasure, as they say. And, you know, I really think that a lot of things we see on the roadshow, for instance, aren't things of extraordinary value, but they have extraordinary sentiment to people. And that's really what creates value, is your emotional connection with something, not necessarily how much it's worth.
Your dad would be proud. Your dad would be proud. You go from this Noah's Ark in New Hudson with mom and dad to a place called Sotheby's.
A little place called Sotheby's.
What was that experience like?
Well, that's really where I was able to work hands-on in the back of the house, cataloging everything from Hummels to Impressionist paintings. So it gave me a wide array of things to look at, to handle, to turn around, smell, touch, almost taste, and really get an intimate experience, you know, with all of these objects, which is crucial. You have to have the academic side, but you also have to have the hands-on side. So Sotheby's provided that for me.
How does one become an expert in appraising collectibles?
Well, partly just what I explained. You have to really put your time in on the bottom line, meaning you have to start from the ground up. You have to start handling objects, looking at objects, familiarizing yourself with everything out there, whether it's working in a museum, whether it's working at an auction house, whether it's just going to tag sales, reading things, trade magazines, things that educate you, educate the eye. That's how you begin. And then the other component, you know, is the academic side. It's really twofold.
They talk about the glass ceiling for women. In this profession of appraisal, it was a glass floor that was totally dominated by men. Mm-hmm. How did you become so successful in this extremely male-dominated profession?
Well, I always regarded it, I think, as a challenge, an opportunity. I was not intimidated by it. I really felt that it was an opportunity to be exploited. And quite honestly, a lot of men in the industry were very helpful to get me where I am today. You know, I sort of stood on their shoulders, so to speak, and now other people stand on mine. So I sort of passed that along to other people.
If there's a young lady listening today that wants to become the best in a male-dominated profession, what would you say to her?
I would say to really not be intimidated by the gender of the people in the profession, because we all approach this with different skill sets. And if that person has amazing skill sets, her gender's not going to make any difference whatsoever. She's going to achieve the highest level possible as any male would. So, you know, there's an even more of an even playing field now, I think, in this profession than there used to be.
We're talking to Caroline Ashley, who's appraised billions of dollars worth of collectibles. And I'm Jack Grisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Grisula.
Welcome back. We're with Caroline Ashley, the founder of Caroline Ashley Associates, a firm that provides appraisal and auction services. Caroline, tell us about art.
What specifically would you like to know about art? That's a pretty big topic. Were you interested, Jack, in asking me about what attracts me? What sorts of things do I buy?
If a blind person asked you, Caroline, what is art? What would you tell them?
I think that art is not necessarily what you look at. In other words, it's not necessarily that impressionist painting in a museum. It's what you see. It's your interpretation that makes it art. And that's very individual. That's very unique for each and every person. And that's the beauty of it.
As I think about it, I think a blind person would tell you, here's what art is to me. Because a person's voice, etc., how they express themselves,
exactly.
That's art.
Exactly, yes.
That's art. Your parents, Caroline, taught you about art. You, in turn, have taught your son, Drew, about art. Is this love for art in your genes, or do we all have the love for art in us?
I think we all have that love of art in us, and there's different types of art. You know, there's visual art, there's performing art, There's many different kinds of art, as anyone might define it. And I think that that desire for inspiration and creativity is something that we all possess.
All kids love to draw with crayons. You see them go to a restaurant and they give them the little sheet with the crayons and away they go. Why is that?
Well, I think that there's a creative urge, as I expressed. I mean, if you think about it, if you go back to Paleolithic times, cave people were drawing on walls. They were drawing things that were meaningful to them. They were drawing animals from the hunt. They were doing it in the caves of Altamira, Spain. They were doing it in Australia in the caves. And coincidentally, even though they were separated by all these oceans and continents, they were creating the same images. So I think that it's part of our human DNA, so to speak. I tend to think that that creative impulse is something that's just inherent in we as humans, as we are as human beings.
A lot of parents, a lot of aunts and uncles, a lot of teachers have taken children to the art museums, etc. What does that experience do for a child?
Well, it certainly expands their experiential background. And I think, once again, as I was saying, my parents did for me, it helps educate their eye. It helps them gain experience and confidence in looking at things and trusting their own intuition and interpretation of what they're looking at. I think that's a very important component.
We've just experienced another spring in Michigan. And every spring in this state, God's angels work 25 hours a day painting with unbelievable colors and paintbrushes. The greatest artist of all time is God. Talk to us about God the artist.
Well, I think he is the we know he is the master, and if God were to create a masterwork, I think it's called his creation. And I think he figured that out a long time ago. I think that if there is a masterwork of God, it is his creation. I think it's simply that.
What kind of art does God have on display in heaven?
Well, whatever he has on display, I think, is beyond our human interpretation. I think it transcends our human interpretation. As I say, I think that it embodies all of creation. It's totally expansive.
You go to the Louvre in Paris. And if they took all of the art off the walls, just the ceilings, the walls, the floors, the marble, it's unbelievable. But you walk into this one room, and one of the smallest paintings in the whole place is this Mona Lisa. It might be 2 foot by 3 foot or so. And everybody's drawn to the Mona Lisa. And whatever angle you look from, she's looking at you, whether you're left, right. How does that happen?
Well, I certainly think a lot has to do with technique. You know, I think that the artist can use certain techniques that create that illusion. I also think that part of it is the fact that if you look at the Mona Lisa, she's looking directly at the viewer. It isn't a side angle. Her view is directly at the viewer, so that when you move, it appears as though her glance is moving with you. And it kind of creates that emotional connection with a work of art that transcends the oil, the canvas that it's on. And that's what we call masters, people who can create that kind of thing in a two-dimensional form.
Can your eye, if there were 50 young artists, can you pick out which one or two will eventually be known as masters?
Well, I think a lot of people try to do that. But again, it's very interpretive. It's very individual. If you were to ask that question to people who were looking for expert technique, you might get one answer. If you were asking that question to people who were looking at emerging artists, emerging talent, you might get another answer. It all depends on the criteria one is using, I think, to determine who future artists are going to become.
Speaking of masters, Michelangelo was one of the masters. And you go to St. Peter's and you see the Pietà.
Mm-hmm.
And he once said, "All I've done is free the Pietà from the stone." What was he telling us?
What I think he's describing is using his creative energy to be able to translate something into an inanimate object to a thing that's much more animate, in the sense that it is going to embody to us a shape, a form that can convey an emotion that we can interpret, we can look at. And his ability to take that hard rock and turn it into something that we can identify as human form and to relate to it is true artistry.
If somebody brings a collectible to you, how do you determine its authenticity?
This is a difficult topic in many ways because, first of all, appraisers are not authenticators. That's a misconception, but there are authenticators in the world, and those people usually are part of the artist's family, people who've worked closely with that individual, who have seen his works of art, and who know what he's worked on and what he hasn't. Those are the people who determine authenticity. There's an interesting quote by an individual by the name of Thomas Hoving, who was a past curator of the Metropolitan Museum in New York, and he said that 80% of all things that he saw pass through the museum were fake. So that tells you how many things are of questionable vintage or authenticity.
We're talking to Caroline Ashley, and I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Now, here's your host, Jack Crisula.
Welcome back. We're with Caroline Ashley, who's become world-class in an extremely male-dominated profession. Caroline, how do you appraise a one-of-a-kind item?
There are few, truth be told, one-of-a-kind items. As they say, there's not much new under the sun. So when I work and have worked in this business for over 20 years, almost 25 now, I've seen many things that many people come to me and think are one-of-a-kind objects. But in fact, they are possibly very unique, but not necessarily one-of-a-kind. So the way I approach it, if it's so unique that there are very few comparables that exist in the world, let's say auction comparables, I look at things that are similar. Similar, let's say, in terms of the material that's used, similar in terms of age, condition, quality, etc. And I use those similarities to hone in on the value of things. So it's a little bit of an art and a little bit of science put together.
How do we learn more about Caroline Ashley Associates?
Well, you can go to the website, www.appraiseyourart.com, which is the website we use for people who are interested in appraising things, and www.auctionyourart.com is the site that is used for people who wish to sell things through my firm.
Caroline, why do people collect stuff?
That's a really good question. I think the question is not dissimilar to the question of why do people fall in love? The answers are sometimes irrational and always varied. But I think a common thread is that people who like to collect things do so out of passion. they like to collect out of curiosity. And then there's the emotional attachment they have to certain things. And then, of course, secondarily, some people collect out of an eye toward financial gain.
What advice would you give someone who wants to start collecting?
My advice is this, Jack. I think that people who should start collecting should narrow the field in terms of really thinking about the things that they're emotionally attracted to, the things that really speak to them. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But things that they're attracted to, I also think that if they've narrowed the field and they've decided they want to collect in a certain genre, then it's very important to collect the best of what you can afford and find things in the best condition that you can possibly find them, because those will be the best investments for the future.
Recently, you've appraised a celebrity's client collection that's worth over $50 million and an institutional client's collection worth over $900 million. The numbers are staggering. Do you ever mull in your head these numbers?
At the time I'm doing an appraisal, I don't. I really submerge myself in the act of looking at these things and appreciating these things. And then when I write the appraisal, when I have to come to a final value opinion, yes, sometimes it's totally staggering, even for me. You know, I'm just amazed at the total value of a collection, let's say that a person has collected, let's say the celebrity collection over $50 million worth, the time and the energy and the dedication that it took that individual to put together a collection of that magnitude. That's what's staggering to me.
Has there been one or two items in all these years, in these billions of dollars, that you've held and said, wow?
Well, one of the wow factors, two of the wow factors that come to mind were praising one of the pairs of ruby slippers that Judy Garland wore in The Wizard of Oz. And, of course, that was one of the films I loved as a child that so many people can relate to. And I actually got to hold a pair and eventually got to appraise a pair. One sold it goes back about 7 years, sold for $66,000. That was an amazing find. But I think that the other thing that was amazing for me was to be able to appraise the dress that Marilyn Monroe wore in the 7-Year Itch, the subway dress that blew up. That was also a very interesting piece that ended up selling to an Asian collector in the millions of dollars.
Did you either try on those shoes or try on that dress, Caroline Ashley?
I was not allowed to try on either. And I misspoke. It's $660,000.
For the shoes?
Yes.
If PBS's Antiques Roadshow came to your house, what would we see? Or what do you collect?
A lot of people ask me that question. How did I get in the business and what do I collect? And I finally figured out that even though I've told people what I collect through the years and, you know, I accession and deaccession things, the real thread that weaves it all together is the fact that I think I collect objects not from an object standpoint. They're not object driven. They're actually subject driven. And what I mean by that is I like to collect things that speak to me. I like to collect things that tell a story, that talk to me about their origin, who made them, who collected them. These are the things that fascinate me, and these are the things that I develop an emotional connection to and love to bring home and add to my collection. This is the reason that I collect, is to find out more about what these objects tell me. And in a moment, I'll tell you about one of those examples.
Please.
Well, I was up north, northern Michigan, and I had a client that bought an old train depot. And in the train depot, there were lots of objects, and much of this space was really untouched for many, many years. But I noticed in one dingy little corner, there was a steamer trunk. And I knew that because of what it looked like, it was a Louis Vuitton trunk, and this trunk was from the latter half of the 1800s, 19th century, and that was in the age of, the golden age of travel, when people traveled a great deal by steamship and by rail. They'd put their belongings in these huge trunks, and they'd be, you know, out at sea or on the rail for months at a time. And so these steamer trunks hold a lot of history. They have labels from places where they've been. And I knew just looking at the outside of it that it had to have been owned by a person that had some standing, because it was an expensive piece of luggage even then. So I opened the trunk to reveal all of these objects, mostly clothing. But one of the pieces of clothing, there were shoes, there were dresses, was a very special dress. And that dress happened to be a satin wedding gown. In not great condition, because of course, you know, over time it had some condition issues. But I noticed that in the sleeve there was sewn something that was apparent was inside. I opened the seam to find this little handwritten note that was written from a mother to a bride on the eve of her wedding. And it said something to the effect that, "May you go forward in life on a path strewn with thornless roses." Now, for me, that kind of experience is what creates the mystery and the discovery of objects that keeps me in this business, that keeps me fascinated with what I do and makes it never, ever boring.
We're talking to Caroline Ashley, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with PBS's star appraiser on Antiques Roadshow, Caroline Ashley. Caroline, you've been blessed with a lot of great talents, and God has really blessed you, one of which is that you've kept your enthusiasm and your childlike wonder. It's a great trait. If somebody's listening tonight and senses that, and they say, "I don't have that right now. I've lost that." How do they get that childlike wonder back?
Well, first of all, I'd like to just preface my response by saying that I'll just bet that many of the people you've interviewed in this program, on this show, have imparted almost the same kind of information, whether they're appraisers or they're politicians or they're in the sports arena. I think that when you find your true avocation in life, I think that you sort of find that sweet spot where the energy flows. And you and I have talked about that before. And I think that once you find that, you really do come to a sense of higher purpose sometimes that inspires you and elevates you to do your best work. I think part of my responsibility is to be able to share that with people coming up in the profession and to share with them my enthusiasm and my energy and impart and imbue them with the excitement that I come to work with every day that just keeps my batteries completely charged. And I do think that part of the way in which we want to help people coming up into our professions, whatever they may be, is to help them in an apprentice type of manner, to be able to share our knowledge, but also give them the chance to get out there and experiment, to make mistakes, to have successes, and to learn from them, and to constantly be there as a support system to encourage them so that they continue on and they achieve their goals or whatever happens to be the most passionate thing for them. For me, it's art and antiques. It could be many things for many different people, but I think that that common thread is just finding one sweet spot, and then I think the doors open.
We need to be brave in today's times. And it's very hard for a lot of people to take risks. Boy, your whole life has been risks, mm-hmm. and being brave. Talk to us about taking risks.
Well, I remember a couple of the first risks I took. I decided to go into this business, and my father said to me, "How are you going to make a living at this?" And I said, "Dad, I'll figure it out." And at that, then I decided to go on a motorcycle trip through Europe and to visit every single cathedral, every single museum that I could possibly afford to go see. Did I do it with my dad's approval? No, that was a big risk. But I came back with a huge learning experience that was invaluable. That was a risk, but it paid off huge dividends in the end result. And then I think taking risks to, you know, go into the museum world, to go into the auction world, to go on to TV with Antiques Roadshow, those were all risks, things where you either kind of sink or you swim. But I think unless you try your mettle, you never really know what you're made of. So I think it's very important to stretch yourself in as many ways as you possibly can.
When a person figures out what they love to do, then they have to work the rest of their life in the hope of becoming the best at that. You've become one of the world's best in appraising collectibles. Talk to us about becoming the best in something.
The bar is always higher. So in other words, once anyone achieves a certain level, instead of becoming comfortable in that level, at that level, or in that range of skills, I think that you have to keep challenging yourself. I think other people will challenge you as well. And I think all those challenges perfect our talents and help us become the best of who we can be. And again, as I said before, I think one of the best ways in which to become the best is to take risks, to make mistakes, because we really do, in the end result, learn best from our mistakes. And every time I look at a new thing, I say to myself, you know what, there's something here that I've never encountered before, and that is going to help me perfect my ability, help me stretch my mind, my talents, to continue to become better and better and better. And in my profession, it's a humbling one. We're always confronted with new challenges.
Everybody wants to feel important and appreciated. And people come to you with these possessions from their grandparents, parents, whatever, you know, that's special to them, and asking you to appraise it. And in today's times, time after time, it's worth less than they thought it was worth. How do you tell them it's worth less than they wanted it to be or hoped it to be and still make them feel important?
You know what I find, Jack? A lot of times I think we're under the misconception that people are always interested in the value of something. What I found working on Antiques Roadshow is what they're really interested in is the history of these things. and the meaningfulness that these things have in their own lives, the sentimental value that they hold for them, which is priceless. There's no dollar amount you can apply to something that has a human connection for someone or a sentimental value for someone. So for me, I always tell people that although it may not have a great deal of financial worth, the sentimental value, the emotional connection that they have with these treasures is something you could never put any price on, no matter what.
You're in the business of stuff, Caroline Ashley. How do you ensure that stuff doesn't control your life?
Well, it does control many, many people's lives. And I think that we really have, I have to be cognizant all the time of realizing that in the end result, we're all only custodians, that all of these things are going to pass from us to someone else in the future, whether it's a family member or someone else. And the best we can be are very, very good custodians. We don't really own any of these things. And they should not possess us.
What advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
I would say that if they wanted to get into my profession, the very first thing to do would be to find a mentor like me, or to find a mentor at one of the appraisal organizations, the Appraisers Association of America, the AAA, the ISA, the International Society of Appraisers, or the ASA, the American Society of Appraisers, and to find out what things they need to do to prepare themselves for getting involved in this profession. But first of all, to find someone who's going to give them very good advice and sort of lead them down the right path to make that journey a little easier.
Caroline Ashley, you are a role model. You're an inspiration. You're doing a great job in God's master plan. Keep it up.
Thank you so much, Jack. Pleasure to be here.
Please join us next Sunday when our guest will be the all-time winningest basketball coach in collegiate history, Coach Don Meyer. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible.